Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
All right, welcome to the show. In this edition of Where Did the Road Go, I'm going to be talking with Mike Suave about the John Teeter legend. And I wasn't really familiar with John Teeter all that much. I knew the name, but I'd never really followed it. The book was excellent, really kind of outlined everything and all the major players in the game, and I found it really fascinating, and I enjoyed talking to Mike about this. I recommend picking up the book if you want to get some down-to-earth information on a very out-there story. All right, lots of cool stuff coming up, and been a little bit slow on putting up shows lately because I've had some technical issues, but those are mostly resolved, so I've got a bunch of shows in the backlog I'm going to be putting up. Some really interesting stuff. Okay, if you want to help out the show, please become a patron. It's $3 a month. You get extra stuff, and hopefully within the next month or so, I'm going to have some merchandise available, and you'll get a discount on that as well. You can do that at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And if you are a patron, thank you so much. And really, thank you to anyone who listens to the show and, you know, share it with people. Let's expand this. Let's get this out there as much as possible. And for everyone who does do that, again, thank you. All right, so here, without any further ado, is my conversation with Mike Suave. All right, I'm here with Mike Suave. And how are you doing, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
All right. Now, you've written this book, Who Authored the John Teeter Legend. Before we get into that, tell people a little bit about you, like what other stuff you've done, because I know you've done at least a little other writing work.
Yeah, sure. So I live in Toronto, Ontario, and I got a journalism degree from Ryerson University. I've done some general assignment reporting, some arts reporting. I've written for the National Post here in Canada, written for Variety, the Hollywood trade magazine, done some reporting on Toronto International Film Festival here. But then a couple years ago, I started writing fiction. I've had two fiction books published so far with a collection of short stories on the way as well. And I also now have an agent for my fiction career, so things are on a bit of an upswing there.
Nice.
And Who Authored the John Teeter Legend was my first nonfiction book.
Okay. And this is – it's a fairly short book.
Yep. And about 130 pages or so.
Yeah. Is it just an ebook, or is there a physical copy available as well?
No, there's a physical copy as well.
Okay. And available through Amazon?
Yep. On Amazon or through my website. I don't know if people know this, but when you buy directly from CreateSpace, the author or the publisher tends to get a slightly higher percentage. So if you buy it off my website through the CreateSpace link, it's a little better for me.
Nice. Okay. Well, that's good to know. What is your website?
It's MikeSauve.com.
You want to spell your last name?
Sure. S-A-U-V-E.
Okay. You broke up there. It was S-A-U-V-E.
Yep.
All right. Before we get into the story of John Teeter, what made you want to write this?
Well, I've always been interested in the type of subjects you cover on your show and the types of things you might hear on a program like Coast to Coast AM. But time travel is probably always up there as one of my favorites. Even as a kid, I remember just a movie like 12 Monkeys or even a little more something like Time Cop even. I just love the idea of time travel. And I can remember the day I first discovered John Teeter. It was one of those nights where, you know, you're spending a little too much time on YouTube and at 2 o'clock turns to 3 o'clock and in the morning that is. But I heard a Coast to Coast episode on John Teeter. And I remember just getting this like shiver of excitement because I thought, wow, there's some real validity here. There's something, this isn't going to be easily debunked. And as I was listening to that show, I was Googling and I was seeing, starting to read the post and seeing some of the images that John Teeter uploaded. So I became an instant devotee. And then from that point on, I started communicating with other people online. And whenever there'd be a new development in the story or there'd be a new radio program about the story, I was always very excited about it. So the time came when I realized this is a subject that I'd be interested in writing about. And I thought because a lot of this information is spread out on different parts of the internet, on message boards, I thought I'd be doing a service to people where to put it all in one place where they could just get my book and then they would have this kind of encapsulation of some aspects of the story.
Okay. And what is the John Teeter story? When you first wrote me, you said I tracked down sort of the legend of the John Teeter story, and I'm thinking John Teeter. I know that name. And the first thing that came to mind was that the guy who claimed to go to Mars with Obama?
That's Andrew Baggiago.
Yes, yeah.
He's another time traveler. Yeah, was alleged time traveler.
And I know there was some, you know, like I know there was some background there where people think there was some political stuff involved as to where that story came from. But this one I was less familiar with, but I have heard the name John Teeter. And this goes back much farther than that one.
Yeah, John. So a man calling himself John Teeter, which he said all along was a pseudonym. He came online around 2000, towards the end of 2000. He was online for 5 months, and he claimed to be a time traveler from the year 2036. He claimed that he'd been sent back in time to 1975 to retrieve an IBM 5100 computer, which would be needed in his future, or in 2036, that is, to emulate between Unix, APL, and BASIC. And what differentiates John Teeter from somebody like Andrew Baggiago is the depth and the complexity of his story. I don't really buy what Andrew Baggiago is selling. I think it's a fun story, but it's pretty out there for my tastes.
Yeah.
Whereas John Teeter, there's all these things combined. So one of my book, it sets aside the question of whether or not he was real to say, if he wasn't real, who came up with this story? And whoever did it had all these different talents. They had a great deal of physics knowledge. They had the ability to almost a novelistic ability to tell a story. They were well versed in philosophical issues surrounding time travel. And time and again, so the people that John was interacting with on these message boards, these are people on time travel message boards, so some of them worked in physics, and they're asking him high-level physics questions that are like well beyond my pay grade to comprehend.
Right.
And time and again, he's answering them in near real time with very credible answers, like PhD caliber answers. So at the very least, this is somebody who put a great deal of effort into making this story. So even if it is a hoax, the nature of the story itself and its richness makes for an interesting enough mystery in its own right.
Okay. And what were his claims like? What is the John Teeter thing?
Well, the main gist of the story, like I said, was retrieving that computer. But the story is, like I said, is quite rich. He talks about he predicts a societal collapse in the United States. There's a nuclear attack from Russia, and this precipitates civil war. And some of these claims didn't come to fruition. For example, he said there would be no Olympics in 2008. He said civil war would begin in 2005. And of course, we know none of these things happened.
Right.
But John has this kind of out, which debunkers are happy to jump on, and it's the idea that he relies on the unlike, you know, in a movie like 12 Monkeys or in a classic time travel stories, it's always linear. You can go back, you kill Hitler, you come back to your timeline, World War II never happened. But John relies on much more contemporary modes of time travel, which coincidentally or interestingly are exactly how popular science writers like Michio Kaku and Brian Greene speculate that it would happen. So he relies on the many worlds interpretation, meaning he left his timeline to come to our timeline. So nothing that happened on our timeline was guaranteed to be what happened on his. So that's kind of the out he has with for whenever there's a wrong prediction. But he also had a number of correct predictions that are what sort of lends the story validity to this day.
Okay. Now he first appeared in 2000, but didn't he pop up, like, didn't he say he had to go back to, he went back to 1975 to get the IBM, but there was something about him going back to 1998 as well?
Yeah, and this is where it gets a little bit complicated. So the basic deal, 2036 to 1975, then back to 2000, where he said he was doing basically like anthropological work. So talking to people on the internet was part of his information gathering. But then he did say that he had to he had to retrace his steps, as it were, to get back to 2036. And part of doing that involved going to 1998. And this is fascinating because there were two faxes sent to Art Bell in 1998 that aren't signed by John Titor, but have many aspects of the John Titor story in them. So if we're to assume that this was maybe a proto attempt at telling the story, then the storytellers decided, well, we have to cover our tracks and explain these 1998 faxes to Art Bell, and therefore we have to have John go back to 1998. Now, one really interesting thing is some of these people that were interacting with John, one in particular, Pamela Moore, she says that at the time, nobody remembered these 1998 faxes to Art Bell, almost as if he really did go back and do it. And so it hadn't occurred when they were interacting with him, and it occurred retroactively. So if you do believe what he's saying, that's one of the more, you know, shiver-inducing aspects of the story.
Right, right. And he did go into detail about his time machine.
He did, yep. And he described it as using a being powered by two mini black holes, and he said that these mini black holes would be developed at CERN. And as we know, CERN, just shortly about 6 or 7 months after he wrote that, they announced for the first time that they would be trying to create mini black holes. And that's it. This is one more aspect of the John Titor story that I love, because now, you know, in the circles that you run in, we talk about CERN all the time. But in 2000, 2001, CERN wasn't on the tip of everybody's tongue. It was more, you know, esoteric for people that were really into physics. So he's referring to these things that would happen at CERN. So at the very least, he's very plugged in to what's going on in those physics circles.
And his time machine is essentially a car.
It's inside of a car. So the basic idea is that the time machine sort of emits like a gravitic field around it that will encompass everything within a certain amount of space. So the car is just basically the conveyance that holds the time machine and that he would sit within. It was a 1967 Corvette, incidentally.
And of course, that immediately harkens back to the Future.
Yeah, that's one. There's a section in the book called pre-existing influences. So I say, if maybe the story was made up, what are some of the pre-existing influences? And of course, Back to the Future and the car is almost so on the nose that I almost didn't even think about it at first. And the interesting thing about that car is somebody told me that somebody was saying, well, what are the odds they'd still have cars from 1967 around in 2036? And somebody told me that that model had the body was made of fiberglass, so there'd be an increased likelihood that something like that would age a lot better than a body made of steel.
Hmm. Okay. And I mean, the computer story to me seems like it's a little fishy, too. Like, why would you need that particular IBM?
Yeah, and why couldn't you just create that technology yourself? If you can create the technology to travel through time,
yeah,
why can't you create a technology to emulate between Unix, APL, and BASIC? But the fascinating thing about the computer is so that actual function to translate between those languages, very few people knew that, because the IBM didn't want that getting out, because it would hurt the sales of their other computers. Because then people could just buy that one. They wouldn't have to buy different computers to do different things. So the numbers vary, but Oliver Williams, who runs JohnTitor.com, he reached out to some of these IBM engineers who were involved in the manufacture of the 5100, and I've heard the numbers range that only 20 people in the world knew the information that John was saying. So this brings up an interesting point. Is the author of the John Titor story someone who knows this little kernel of rare information, and they make it the centerpiece for weaving this tale because they know it's eventually going to get discovered that, hey, what he's saying here is true and not many people know this?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, whoever did it was very smart. There's no two ways about that. This wasn't just thrown together.
Oh, no, and that's what... Another motivation for writing the book is I was actually looking at your website today, and I saw the section on debunkers versus skeptics. And I myself, very you know, I get a little hot under the collar with some of these debunkers that just say, oh, John Teeter, that's been debunked, you know, because they read the Wikipedia entry or something. And they don't look at all these details. You know, they just say, you can read Wikipedia and there's a section that says predictive failures. And they'll say, okay, he predicted a civil war in 2005. That didn't happen. Case closed. And, you know, like there's a Skeptoid episode, for example, the podcast Skeptoid. He spends 10 minutes ridiculing the story without addressing a single aspect of the story, just basically saying, how can people believe this? So I thought it's similar to another book on John Teeter called Conviction of a Time Traveler. It basically, what I hope to do is just hold up a lot of this information to say, look, all, you know, if you want to dismiss the John Teeter story, that's fine, but at least you have to acknowledge all these facets of it.
Yeah. It's very well crafted, if nothing else.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing I often say is that there's a good chance it wasn't one person, but a team of people, five people maybe. So maybe one guy is the physics guy, one guy is the writer, another guy is just a manager. And so that's very likely as well.
So let's talk about some of the possibilities here as to who may have authored this whole thing. The first one you address in the book is Larry Haber.
Sure. Larry Haber is a entertainment lawyer based out of Florida, who came forward in around 2004, claiming to represent the mother of John Teeter, Kay Teeter. And he would make the rounds. He's been on Coast to Coast. He's been on Jimmy Church. And he was the gatekeeper between this John Teeter family and the public. And he was also responsible for new developments in the story. There's a website, the John Teeter Foundation website, that it actually posted a message from John Teeter. This was a few years ago. I want to say 2011, but I could be wrong. And it's a message from John Teeter. And there's also a on that website, there's a graph of coordinates, and the basic concept is that there's all these multiple Johns coming back, and they need these divergence coordinates in order to get back to their different individual world lines. So Larry Haber, more than anyone else, has, if we're assuming that this isn't, if John Teeter isn't a real time traveler, has done more to advance the story than anybody else. But there's a saying that my friend Dan Scott has, and it's all roads lead to Larry Haber. There's no real way to get around Larry Haber's involvement. So whether Larry Haber is a front man for whoever wrote this story, some people think it might have been one of Larry Haber's brothers, Richard or Maury Haber, because both of them work in IT. And or whether Larry is an unwitting frontman, whether there is a consortium that wrote the story and they hired Larry because he said he's been hired through a third party. So there's different permutations of how and why Larry might be involved. Now, there was an interesting development with Larry recently. He was on Jimmy Church, and he said that 8 months ago, the family had dismissed him. They'd basically terminated their contract with him. They didn't need his services anymore. And this was interesting because a week before that interview, I was still talking to Larry, asking him questions, and he was still responding to them as though he were the lawyer for the family. So my belief is there's this guy out there. His name's Rasmus, the hoax hunter, and he's come up with a lot of the best research into John Teeter, and a lot of it does point a finger at the Haber family. But he had just released what he called a smoking gun video that implicated some of Larry's brothers. And my belief is that it just got to be too much for either Larry or for his brothers, and he just had to pull pins on the situation, because a week prior to that, he was still acting as though he were the lawyer, but then he claimed he'd been dismissed 8 months ago. So that doesn't really add up to me. But I will say, you know, we talked about Andrew Baggiago earlier, and he kind of gets all this credibility in the alternative media because he's a lawyer. So, like, as though a lawyer couldn't, you know, be crazy, or a lawyer couldn't make something up.
Right.
But I will say, Larry, in my dealings with him and in just, you know, I'm his friend on Facebook, he definitely seems like a, you know, a upstanding, respected member of his field. So this is the thing I've always struggled to reconcile, is why would a lawyer in good standing put themselves out there like this? Like, I just can't reconcile Larry making up a client or being intentionally duplicitous. It just doesn't strike me as being part of his character. So there's, it's a mystery. What motivates Larry Haber is at the absolute core of the John Teeter story.
And if I remember right, you said he has like a ton of regular clients who are professional.
Yeah, he does work for Disney and Universal Studios, and he does contract law, and he does a little bit of entertainment law, and so he basically said that a law school colleague of his, who he hadn't even seen since law school, had been approached by this Kay Teeter woman, which is also a synonym, and he's never met Kay, but he's had phone conversations with her. And you could, if you had a question, you could relay it to him and he would get it to her. And, for the most part, that's the other thing about him is, again, to make the Baggiano comparison, he's not really out there looking for a lot of attention about this. He'll diligently respond to questions, usually with like a one-word answer, because as you can imagine, he's got other clients. This isn't resulting in a ton of billable hours for him. Right. And he treats it as just kind of what he projects anyways, is that it's just kind of an amusing diversion that fell into his lap. It's like the strangest thing that's happened to him in his career. That's what how Larry projects it anyways.
And that's reasonable. I mean,
yeah.
It doesn't mean he's necessarily responsible behind it. And in the book, you do talk to Larry. You have an interview that you put in here with him.
Mm-hmm.
You interviewed a lot of these people, and some of them were a lot more open to talking about things than others.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Outside of Larry, people in this realm tend to be very married to their opinions. So I mentioned the hoax hunter earlier. He is dead set that he's debunked this story, that it's over, that Maury Haber is the author, and that anyone who's saying differently is essentially just ignoring the truth because we want to keep propagating this story, whether it's for entertainment or for ratings if you're a radio show host or financial reward. But the truth is, I really think that there hasn't been that firm. A lot of people would happily accept some firm evidence, but it just really hasn't manifested. And then similarly, there's Temporal Recon, who wrote that book I mentioned earlier, Conviction of a Time Traveler, and he's dead set that he has proved that John Teeter was real. And he says the same thing as Hoax Hunter, that the only reason people don't just accept the truth is because they want to just keep propagating the story. So a lot of people tend to get very dogmatic about their opinions of the John Teeter story, and they're very passionate about it. But so far, I was a little worried when I wrote the book that people might, I might be given a hard time by different parties. But so far, everyone's been fairly professional and courteous.
Well,
I'd have to say
you're pretty much just presenting the facts as they are.
Yeah, that was my intention. Not so much to say, okay, case closed. This is the evidence. I just wanted to put all the facts out there so that people who are interested in the story would have them all available and could come to their own conclusions.
Now, Richard and Maury Haber are the brothers of Larry.
Yep.
And they're more likely to have had a hand in it than Larry.
Yeah, there was a Italian television show called Voyager they hired a private investigator to investigate the John Teeter story. And the conclusion he reached was that Richard Haber was the author. He largely based this on Richard Haber's presence at Larry's office at the time, and also the fact that he works in information technology. Now, Rasmus, the hoax hunter, as I mentioned earlier, he believes Maury Haber is the author, and what he relies on primarily is a text comparison, which so he takes some blogs written by Maury Haber, and he takes the posts of John Teeter, and he runs them through this software program that looks for, how many five-word phrases match, how many four-word phrases match. And I think the hoax hunter has done a lot of good work, but I don't think this is as convincing as he thinks it is. The one thing the hoax hunter, or Rasmus, as he prefers to be called, did find was he traced the P.O. box that was associated with the John Teeter Foundation. He found out through White Pages that it was initially registered to Richard Haber. So to me, that's as close to a smoking gun as you probably get. The fact that this John Teeter Foundation P.O. box was initially associated with Richard Haber. And also, I feel like if Larry were to have just, I've asked Larry about this, and if he were to just say to me, oh yeah, that was my brother's P.O. box and then I took it over, I would accept that. But he denies any association whatsoever. And the evidence is there. Like, you can see the old White Pages link. So that's, I think, the closest thing to a smoking gun that associates Richard. The other thing in Hoax Hunter's smoking gun video, which he released on the last day of 2016, is an interview with a third Haber brother, Arthur. And I don't see a lot of validity in it. It's kind of all over the map, and he's talking about aliens and the JFK assassination, I think. But you know, the Hoax Hunter's, you know, he has done some good work, and he's also kind of a true believer in some respects. So some of that. Like that smoking gun video is 2 hours long. Wow. And I mean, it's something, I'll tell you that.
Now, one of the more interesting characters you talk to in here is Joseph Matheny.
Yeah, Joe Matheny.
Matheny, okay.
Yeah, and he was on, so he came on a program called Project Archivist. I think you're familiar with that, right?
Yes, we're good friends with them.
Yeah, and so they had him on, and he claimed that he was responsible for the John Teeter story, and he provided all these details of how I came to be. And I do take issue with sort of the tone of that program, because there's kind of a he's coming off a little bit snide. Like, I can't believe people still believe this. I can't believe I fooled them with just this slapdash thing that we did for fun. And so, for example, he'll say John Teeter provided images of a time machine that no one has really been able to say what it is concretely. And Joe Matheny just says, oh, a prop builder built that. They just tossed it together. And he doesn't really provide a lot of hard evidence. But what does make me consider him a likely subject is almost no one is more qualified to come up with this story or to be responsible for it, because before he allegedly created this John Teeter story, he was responsible for the Incunabula papers, or Ong's Hat, which was one of the first alternate reality games. And it so essentially it's a series of fake documents. Like, it includes a catalog of esoteric books, and but it gets people involved where they're going to the places in it listed in these documents, and they're doing investigation, and they're people were adding to the story on Usenet groups at the time. So in many ways, the John Teeter story functions like an alternate reality game in its own way, because you could say Larry Haber is a player in this game who's pushing the story forward. You could say someone like Oliver Williams is a player in this game. And you could even say I'm a player in this game. And you don't really know who's in on it and who's a passive you know, recipient of it. And but what's so much more fun about it than an alternate reality game is ultimately, you know, an alternate reality game is a game. With the John Teeter story, there's that little seed of doubt that maybe it's real, maybe he is a real time traveler. So you get all the fun of participating in the alternate reality game, but with maybe not the feeling of wasting your time on something silly. I don't know, some people might think it's silly, but I think it's a good 10 minutes, an interesting time. So yeah, Joe Matheny, he made those claims, and obviously that's like a real bomb dropped in the whole John Teeter world, and a lot of people were dismissive of him, and he just feels like he doesn't have anything to prove. He doesn't care if you believe him or not. And Joe Matheny, outside of his alternate reality game credibility, he holds a number of patents. He was a big player in at Netscape and Adobe. He does academic writing now under a pseudonym, so it's not like he needs the attention, and it's not like he kept flogging it for attention after making those initial claims. So Matheny's really interesting to me, but the thing that's hard to put together is that you can't really reconcile the Matheny theory with the Haber theory, because Matheny has essentially called Haber a, quote, gut maggot, because he says, look, I wrote this story with my with four of my friends, and our basic policy was no one could do it for profit. The whole deal was we wanted to do it just to have this story with no author so that people wouldn't be able to pin it on anyone. And he claimed, Matheny claims that when he saw Haber come forward, this angered him. And Haber had published a book, according to Haber, at the family's behest, which is nothing more than the John Teeter Post. And it was called John Teeter, A Time Traveler's Tale. And according to Matheny, the reason that book is no longer available for sale is because he threatened Haber that he would expose him as a liar. So you can see these people are probably not working together since Matheny is saying these nasty things. But this then goes back into what I was talking about with the permutations. How do we know that maybe – okay, so there's the possibility that Haber is just a fraud and he decided to come forward and take credit for Matheny's work. There's also the possibility that Matheny hired Haber through a third party just to give the story or the game this extra layer of realism. So there's different ways you can kind of – compute their association with each other. But Joseph was, if you recall in my interview, he's even, and that was just an email interview, he's a little bit prickly with me. Mm-hmm. He rubbed the wrong way by some of my questions, and I was just happy he was willing to do the interview. And I was expecting he would maybe say something about the book, but I haven't heard from him. So
the book that Larry wrote, did that ever get released?
Or yeah, Larry... He it was released and it was available for a while, and people have copies of it. And that book, when I last checked, it was going for $890 on Amazon, just wow, because it's out of print. And you know, people, and that's not a scam by Larry. That's resellers, right? Just taking mm-hmm. advantage of it's this artifact now that people are fascinated by. And so that's not the only thing that goes for a steep price. That reminds me of so Pamela Moore was the poster that interacted with John the most, and according to her, she was sent a label of the IBM 5100. Mm-hmm. And so if this is true, this is a real important artifact, because this is something that traveled through time. So she doesn't have the capabilities of testing this to see, I don't know how you would test something to see if it went through time, but I'm sure there's some tests you could do that might reveal some anomalies with it. So that was being sold on eBay for $10,000 last wow. year, and it's been taken down. So I guess there were no bidders.
That's not surprising, really.
Yeah. But you know, if I had like $100 million or something, I would probably buy that, but I don't, so I won't. But yeah.
Now let's talk briefly, in case people are not aware, what alternate reality gaming is and what Ong's hat was.
Okay, so alternate reality gaming, I guess this isn't an alternate reality game, but the most populous thing you might be able to think on is something like Pokemon Go, just because it's getting you out and you're getting involved with this narrative. But alternate reality gaming goes a little bit deeper in that it's essentially gets participants to become authors of the story themselves. You can add to the story. And the book, there was actually an academic book written about Matheny called Legend Tripping Online, The Search for Ong's Hat. And the term legend tripping has to do with, so me and you, say, are fans of this Incunabula Papers, Ong's Hat. It's an interchangeable title. We're fans of this narrative. And there's places, it's set around Princeton, New Jersey, and there's talks about wormholes and things of this nature. So then we go to these places together and we make an afternoon out of it. So it's we're not just, you know, clicking a mouse. We're not just reading, you know, sitting in our living room. We're actually getting out and interacting with the story. And it became, it's been used in marketing for different movies. I remember when the movie AI was coming out, the Steven Spielberg movie, they came up with an alternate reality game called The Beast, and that was one of the first commercial alternate reality games. And I believe Matheny was involved with that, although I'm not sure if he takes credit for that or not, but it's been said that he was involved with The Beast. Hmm. So that's alternate reality gaming, and you can see how maybe the John Teeter story falls into that category, because, you know, we're doing things like, okay, so let's say I have that $100 million and then I buy the buy that label and then I take it to the University of Toronto to get it tested, well, then suddenly I'm doing these things and I'm having, presumably I'm doing it because it's fun, but I'm also doing it out of this sense of a, some kind of like a mission. So I do tend to see the story as this big game that we're all kind of trying to crack the puzzle. And that's why maybe those criticisms of Razimus and Temple Recon are true, because, you know, as soon as something really concrete came out, then the game would be over, right? And it wouldn't be as fun anymore. It would be a legend that we would still talk about, but there wouldn't be that sort of the thrill of the chase associated with it.
Okay.
Yeah, speaking of some of these people that have reached out to me, there was one guy, and I'm not going to use his name because I'm not sure if he'd want me to, and he's also disappeared from the internet, so he may even have been a it may not be a real person, it may be, but he had a whole Facebook profile, and he would say some things that were pretty out there, but then he said some things that were really, really eye-opening. So one of John's policies was he wouldn't give details that would help people avoid death by probability, that he wouldn't give you stock tips, he wouldn't tell you who won the World Series that year, because it was against his basic ethics of time travel. But somebody asks him, like, you could tell me something just to avoid escaping death. And this is one of the times where John gives it an exact date, and he does it in a hypothetical way. He says, I'm not sure I'm specific enough to help any individuals avoid anything. Suggesting there is a war coming is a bit different than saying avoid Washington, D.C. at 3:45 a.m. on March 12, 2015. Now, it's kind of interesting that – so he's not saying – he's using that hypothetically, like just this is a specific time. But okay, so why give this time? And this person who reached out to me, he – pointed something out to me that no one had caught on to, and two things happened in that week of March 12, 2015. One, it was the week that Putin was missing for a week. If you recall that, it was very big in the news. Where's Putin? Some people thought he'd been assassinated. And that ties in with the story because Russia is a big aspect of the story. Russia nukes the United States in the John Teeter story. The other thing that happens, and this is, you know, reported in mainstream news, military.com, a woman named Captain Heather Cole, who was worked for a strategic nuclear force with the Navy, she was mysteriously basically fired due to loss of confidence, and no one could say why. And this story, it appeared on Fox News, it appeared on other mainstream sites, and then it got taken down. So naturally, that's going to lead to conspiracy theorists thinking something is up. And in the more conspiratorial articles, they say that she was given an order to launch a nuclear strike on Russia, and that she refused, and therefore was lost her job. And no one has really answered yet why Heather Cole was fired. So those two things both happened in this week of March 12, 2015, which was the only specific date John gave. So I thought that was pretty interesting anyways. I mean, I guess you could say if you name any week, if I just pick a week out of my hat, you know, January 5th, 2022, something is going to happen that week that maybe you could say, oh, see, this is what he was talking about. But the fact that those two things really dovetail with the narrative, with the nuclear bombs and with Russia, I thought it was pretty interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. There's definitely some – any of the predictions made were believable predictions. So,
yeah, I can get into some predictions for you. The one I always say first, as which is my favorite one, because it's very specific. Because I always think like just a talented futurist can make basic predictions, like, oh, Russia and China are going to become a powerful opponent of the United States. Well, if you know world history, you can probably speculate that that's going to happen.
Right.
But somebody asked John, at the time there was a marketing campaign for something called Project IT, and nobody knew what this was. There were commercials. It was supposed to be this big technological revolution, and so somebody asked him, what is it? And John says, it looks like some kind of motorized scooter, and what Project IT turned out to be was the Segway. And right, so he knew this when only – I mean, it was being developed, so there was the marketing team and the – you know, engineers were aware of it, but it was another piece of this rare information that John had. So he predicted the segue. I mentioned the black holes, mini black holes at CERN. He said a lot of things that would go on to happen at CERN that did go on to happen. He described somebody asked him what entertainment was like in the future, and he said it was decentralized and people did it from their own homes, and it was kind of like little plays that, and then it was projected out, and his description was very similar to what YouTube is like.
Yeah.
And this was in 2001. YouTube was just, no one had thought of anything like YouTube yet. If you remember internet streaming quality then, you know, it would take you 15 minutes to download a 2-minute video or something, right? So.
And then it would look like crap.
Yeah. And another thing he said that I always like is that he talked about the way black holes emit radiation in a certain way. And at the time, this was in conflict with what Stephen Hawking said. And then Stephen Hawking, just a few years ago, would later reverse his position on black holes, and it would become in line with what John Titor had said way back in 2000.
Hmm.
So that's a good one. And then I'll just give you one more real quick here. Somebody asked him if he remembers any poetry. And he says he remembers a poem called A Soldier's Winter. And he wrote about 4 lines of this poem from memory. And a few years ago, a poem came out online called A Soldier's Winter, and it had very similar lines. So it makes sense that they wouldn't be exact because, you know, if I asked you to recall a poem without being able to Google it, you probably wouldn't get every word correct unless you were a, you know, poetry buff or a teacher or something. And then, so what makes this fascinating is if this were just a, you know, some guy who wrote it, I'd say, okay, he's just a fan of John Titor and he's role playing and he's having a good time. So he put this out there for another clue to just keep the game alive or keep everybody having fun. But the person who wrote it actually works for the Department of Defense. His name's Larry Kluck. He has wrote a whole book of poems about his experiences as a soldier. And Oliver Williams asked him, "Are you familiar with John Titor?" And he said, "No, I've never heard of John Titor." So it's one of those rare moments, or not even that rare. It's one of those moments where I think, wow, maybe there's something to John Titor's story after all. And that's why the book doesn't come down in any one conclusion. It kind of leaves it all open, because just when I think, okay, well, it has to be Richard Haber because of the P.O. box, or I think it has to be Joseph Matheny because Joseph Matheny had all the skills to do it, then there'd be something that makes you think, no, maybe he was a real time traveler. Maybe that's the answer here. So it always that's what keeps me interested, is it never really, you can never really pin any one thing down for too long.
Yeah, the poem is definitely interesting. I mean, I guess it's not outside the realm of possibility that someone could have convinced him to do it, or that he's just a player in the game and was lying about it.
Yeah, and nothing is, all the evidence that John Titor was a real time traveler is circumstantial. And this is the argument that Temporal Recon makes in his book, that it is circumstantial evidence, but when you add it all up together, it becomes, the burden of proof is almost satisfied, because there's so much of it that comes together. Are you going to tell me that, you know, he had this IBM 5100 knowledge, he had this Segway knowledge, he knew, they were able to plant this Department of Defense guy to write a poem, and then, you know, got these other things correct. In one of the faxes that we talked about earlier, the 1998 fax, he says something that is a favorite among John Titor truthers, if you want to call them that. And he says that there's a skyscraper in New York that hasn't been built. And so, of course, this calls to mind 9/11. He doesn't say a skyscraper was destroyed or anything like that. He says it hasn't been built, which, if you think about it, it could be what's the building that replaced the One World Trade? Is that it?
Yeah, something like that.
So,
World Trade Center 1 or something.
Yeah, so maybe that's the building that hasn't been built. But it's its own – the thing about that prediction is it's its own kind of sentence in the facts to Art Bell, and it's sort of not within the flow of what he's saying. So it just seems like it's this detail that's put in there for a reason. So that always caught my attention.
Hmm. Now, do you have any idea who Temporal Recon was or is?
Well, it's no, I don't. I mean, it's a synonym as well. I have some information as to like his background and some of the work. I know he's done some work with remote viewing, and he's very intelligent. He's very sharp. The book is written in almost like lawyerly, very convincing, kind of academic language. But then his blog tends to be a little more new agey in nature. So I always found that sort of an interesting quandary. And there's some connections between him and Joseph Matheny that both of them deny, which always struck me as its own little mini smoking gun in all this, because Temple Recon wrote a blog post called I can't remember exactly what it was, but it had the word incunabula in it. And the incunabula is like it's a word meaning like an old scroll or pamphlet. So there's no real reason that should have been in the title of his blog post about John Teeter, except to either wink or throw a nod at Matheny. And no matter how hard I try, I could never get him to acknowledge that this is beyond coincidence. And he'll even say, I'm as surprised to see this coincidence as you are. Like, he'll acknowledge that it's hard to fathom. Similarly, he did a radio interview where they asked him if he knew anything about Matheny, and he said no. But I actually have a Facebook screen grab saying that he was planning on going to one of Matheny's events before that interview took place. So there might be some mild deception going on there with Temple Recon and Joseph Matheny. Whenever I focus on this, though, when I was talking to him, he would get kind of annoyed because he doesn't have a ton of patience for people that aren't – he feels he's made such a compelling case in his book that anything else is just a distraction, that you either believe or you're being willfully obtuse. Hmm.
And he was going to publish a second book, right?
Yeah, this second book is – and I published the whole table of contents in the chapter on him just because I thought it was so – if he delivers on what he says he's going to do in that second book, like, it covers a wide, wide range of topics. So I'm really looking forward – like, he'll talk about there being other time travelers on our world line, and I'm just looking at his – table of contents now. Like, he covers a lot of things that I cover, like Marlon Pullman, who filed a patent about based on John Teeter's specs, and the secret song, which was supposedly given to Pamela Moore. Mm-hmm. But he also mentions remote viewing and the Monroe Institute, my work in West Africa and other parts of the world. So if these things all come together, you know, it's going to be something. And I forget what he said, but I remember he was saying he was going to make some very like high end version of the book just for his like people who are close to him, almost like as though he needs his story documented, as though he were somehow tied up in this, like he may be related to time travel in some way. And the thing about Temple Recon is he's very cryptic, and he'll give you these clues as if he's trying to steer you in one direction or another, and it can be kind of frustrating, but it can also be kind of fun. The other thing about Temporal Recon is in the John Teeter post, there's a decided theme of he's a real constitutionalist, know what your constitutional rights are, respect the right to bear arms. If the government starts, you know, tinkering with your right to bear arms, that's when you need to be most alert. And if you follow Temporal Recon's blog, or you follow him on Facebook, these are his concerns. He regularly posts about government overreach and has sort of that same tenor to his own beliefs. So one theory could be Temple Recon's one of the people involved in writing this. That's why he can defend the story so well, and that's why he wants to defend the story so well, because he's proud of it, right? So
right, yeah.
If you're going to buy the Joseph Matheny line, then I have to assume that he's in league with Temple Recon. And because Temple Recon's anonymous, we have no idea what is like the name on his birth certificate is. I assume it's not Temple Recon. That's what I always say. I feel like sometimes I'm in like a Thomas Pynchon novel or something. I'm dealing – like my girlfriend, like, who are you talking to? Oh, Temple Recon. And yep. But yes, what I was saying there is maybe he's Joseph Matheny. Maybe when I'm talking to Temple Recon, I'm talking to Joseph Matheny, and he's just – because that's what In the book I read, Legend Tripping Online, Matheny's the principal way he identifies as a culture jammer. So even when he was deep into Ong's Had and the Incunabula papers, he would give interviews where it wasn't even clear if he perceived Ong's Had to be fiction. He would give interviews where he was talking about the things in Ong's Had like they were real. So it's hard to know when Joseph Matheny is being truthful and when he's being when he's playing with you.
Yeah, he has that trickster sort of thing going on.
Yep. So the same way with being a trickster, you could just say that he just jumped on board to throw a monkey wrench into the John Teeter story just by claiming to be behind it.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about Oliver Williams? He's the other main person you talk about in here.
Yep, Oliver Williams is the webmaster for johnteeter.com, which was the first big John Teeter website. And you can regularly, if you go back, probably find it on YouTube. He regularly appears on Coast to Coast to discuss the John Teeter story. And he has an almost encyclopedic knowledge of every detail of the story. He's also responsible for the posts themselves became corrupted. And if they weren't on his website, a lot of them could be lost to history now. So he's responsible for all that. Some people believe he's behind the story simply because he owns that website. I know Rasmus has accused him of profiteering because I think he had like a cafe press site where he selling like mugs and hats and stuff. I don't really begrudge someone making a few dollars if you put some work into something. So I don't think that's as damning as he might like to make it. But there's also the idea that there's a famous Coast to Coast caller called Signal 7. And some people have said that he sounds a lot like Oliver Williams. So I've listened to it, and I think if it is Oliver Williams, Oliver Williams has a little bit of acting talent that he hasn't come forward with. But it kind of fits in. Like one thing Matheny says in his claims is that they would call into Coast to Coast claiming to be time travelers. And this was kind of the seed of writing the John Teeter story, that time traveler was a hot trope on Art Bell, and so they would call in and do this. So who knows, maybe in the Joseph Matheny permutation, Oliver Williams is one of his pals. And Oliver Williams has no – you can't like track him down. You can't add Oliver Williams on Facebook, so Oliver Williams may not be his real name.
Right.
And he's distanced himself. He was one of the – he was the only person that didn't get back to my interview requests, and he last appeared on Jimmy Church in about 2015, but since then no one has heard from him. And another thing that I think clears him is that his site it looks like a fire or Angel Fire. Was that the old web service?
Yeah, wow.
It's very ancient, and there's dead links on it. So if he was behind the story and he was trying to make something out of it, it'd be very easy for him to update that website.
Yeah.
As it is still like one of the initial landing places for people interested in John Teeter.
Huh.
So yeah, Oliver I think is an interesting character, but I tend to think he's just someone like me who's really into it.
Right, and playing it up a little bit.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit about the pre-existing influences you found.
Yep. So we already mentioned
Back to the Future.
Back to the Future. That's the obvious one. And then there's a book written by a guy named Pat Frank. It's called The Last Babylon, and it shares some of the aspects of the John Teeter story. In the John Teeter story, the day of the nuclear bomb is called End Day, and in A Last Babylon, it has, I think it was also N Day, just OH Day. Yeah, so in one book they call it N Day, and in the John Teeter story, it's N Day. And
yeah.
A Last Babylon, it's H Day. And there's also, they're both, John Teeter lives in Florida, Last Babylon set in Florida. John Teeter, in the post-nuclear world, his family makes their living shipping oranges. The protagonist of A Last Babylon lives on a citrus farm. They also share a lot of themes around self-sustainability and how essentially as a society, we're too coddled. We're not prepared to live without the power grid. So a lot of people have thought that whoever wrote the John Teeter story is a fan of A Last Babylon. And some people have speculated that it may even be a science fiction writer, like a working science fiction writer who's one of the people behind it. There's also a there was a Dungeons and Dragons like game called GURPS Cyberworld, and it was an online game, and it too shares a lot of aspects of the John Teeter story. It talks about militia movements, trouble with the U.S. Constitution, a civil war, and a lot of the timelines are kind of just a few months off. So it could just be that these ideas were kind of out there in the ether. One thing that I always – it's interesting when you go back and listen to old shows about John Teeter. Every – like in 2004 Bush's midterm election, it was, oh, this is the Civil War he was talking about. The country is so divided. 2008, Obama. The country is so divided. This must be the Civil War. And people have always felt like what he was describing with the because he describes a Civil War not between states, as between essentially the left and the right. And again, right now, it seems more plausible than ever, right? And so it's always kind of seemed like this might be, you know, the time that John Teeter was describing. Another pre-existing influence was actually something just ripped from the headlines, essentially, in that if you think back to the mid to late 90s, you know, the world was in a condition of relative stability. The Cold War was over. The terrorism hadn't become the scourge that it is today. And one of the main media narratives was about people like Timothy McVeigh and like the Waco raids, and this idea of, you know, Timothy McVeigh called himself a constitutional defender. So this kind of conflict between the radical right and big government. And so these things were on people's minds. So John Teeter's story plays into that. And I read an article about basically why John Teeter's story compelled so many people, and one of the things in it was, okay, if you're going on like a conspiracy based website, don't tell them everything's perfect in the future. Play into their existing fears or the things they're already worked up about.
And again, a lot of these things are somewhat common sense, so they're believable. You know, none of the predictions are like aliens will come down from, you know, such and such a planet in 2010 and take over the world. It's stuff that's plausible looking at the way the world is going.
Yeah.
So none of them seem completely out there or impossible. And definitely fit the zeitgeist of the time as well.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And he talks about, he paints the picture sort of that I think a lot of these constitutionalist types almost would like to see, because not only is there this conflict, but then they emerge from it living like a simpler life where they've gotten back to community values and they value, you know, so for example, there's no mainstream entertainment. So people get around and they play guitar around a fire. That's their entertainment. Sort of like a 20th century or 19th century, good old-fashioned family values come back into play. So if you're one of these, you know, right-leaning constitutionalist types, that would speak to you. So there's not just the fear aspect, there's also this promise of what would come. And it's interesting because people would say, express sympathy for John, for that he would have to go through this civil war and that, you know, there'd be nuclear war in his lifetime when he was just a boy. And he would say, don't feel sorry for me. I feel sorry for you because you're still stuck in the old paradigm, which is like a rotten paradigm. He had a lot of contempt for our way of life. One thing he was amazed that we would eat food that we didn't know the origins of it, because that's another, he talks about, Creutzfeldt Jakob disease, which is, essentially mad cow disease in humans. And he says this is a serious problem in his time. And that's another one that's really interesting, because the onset for that disease is 20 plus years. So you and I could be, you know, carrying that right now.
Right.
And it's only going to happen later on. So not only is it kind of unfalsifiable, but it's also, yeah, it's possible, right?
What role did Art Bell play in all this?
Well, Art Bell was the recipient of those faxes, the two faxes in 1998, and he was also, in Matheny's version of events, it was the number of time travel callers that Art Bell was getting that inspired them to write the story. And as you probably recall, Art would have time travel open lines. And the great thing about those classic Art Bell shows is if he got a caller that was interesting, he'd really let it breathe. So there are classic time travel callers. There's one called The Man from 2063. There's Signal 7. And he would go on to even have John Titor open lines where John Titor could call in. So Art was influential in that regard. Oh, and the main thing is that John Titor posted on two message boards. One of them was the Time Travel Institute, and the other was Art Bell's post-to-post message board. And some people, when I was on with Jimmy Church was saying that some people think Art's longtime producer Keith Rowland is behind it, and but I haven't really seen much evidence to that.
All right. You talked about Pamela Moore and the hoax hunter. One of the other people you deal with in here is Stephen Gibbs.
Yeah, he is in there for the simple reason that he's actually mentioned in the John Titor posts, and it is. One of the things about the post that Rasmus the Hoax Hunter has speculated is that it's possible that a lot of these posters were plants, and that's why John Titor was able to answer the question so effectively, because he knew them in advance.
Right.
So when there's someone, a real person in the post, it kind of caught my attention. And Stephen Gibbs is another he's been on Coast to Coast, and he claims to have invented something called a hyperdimensional resonator, which is a time machine that relies on astral travel. So I don't buy into this. I give this even less credence than Andrew Baggiago. I think it's kind of funny though, because it's basically like you buy this thing for like $300, and then if it's not working, it's like, oh well, your chakras aren't aligned, or oh, you're not close enough to a portal, or
yeah.
And somebody wrote an article about it that was quite funny, because there's actually a part that you attach to your like your genitals, and this is the idea of buying this thing and doing that with it. It just seems insane. So yeah, that's why Stephen Gibbs is in there. It was just kind of amusing to me, and I thought it'd be a good maybe diversion from some of the more serious stuff.
And the last person you have in here is Marlon Pullman.
Yeah, Marlon Pullman. He filed a patent application based on the exact schematics that John Titor gave online, and the patent application even includes a pullout drawing that John Titor provided. And just a quick diversion about this pullout drawing, because we didn't mention it. It's essentially like a technical drawing of a time machine, and people have said this would take like a professional draftsman a week to draw, because this was before you had digital technology to do these things, or at least before it was in common use. So it's not like today where some kid can pull up Illustrator, whatever you would do that in, and just do it. So somebody put all that time into it. And yeah, so that made it into Pullman's patent. Pullman is a PhD. His field is Oracle management, which is like database management. And this was kind of like his side project. And of course, the patent, anyone can file a patent, and it doesn't have to be approved. And one of the aspects of this patent is it's relying on technology that we don't yet have. It's relying on mini black holes, which,
right,
you know, he can't create a mini black hole in his laboratory, right? So, and then the story of Marlon Pullman gets a little bit sad, because he was arrested and charged with drugging and sexually assaulting women. So he's actually in jail right now. So we can only speculate, but you see this person who has a PhD, and he works in a very you might almost call it a stodgy field, database management. Like, database management doesn't attract cranks and loons, right? It attracts
generally
people down to earth, essentially, or you know, at least able to get, you know, focus on sort of finite details. And then you see, I'm only speculating, but you can sort of see he was there's when you read the news stories about his conviction, there's drugs involved and ecstasy and ketamine. So you can kind of speculate that maybe he was using these drugs and it led to a sort of grandiosity where he said, okay, I'm going to invent time travel now. So, yeah, that's a little bit of a sad ending, I guess.
When I finished reading this, my basic conclusion is, if nothing else, it's a fascinating story. If it's not real, whoever invented it did so in a way to make it near impossible to truly debunk.
Yeah, I would agree, and that's kind of the conclusion I came to as well, and it's why I wrote the book, and I wanted to, like I said at the outset, put all this information together so that people, because I think if you were to take my book and you take Temporal Recon's book, you've got a pretty comprehensive version of the story, because he covers, was John Teeter real, in absolute detail, and then so I didn't feel the need to go back over that ground because he did a good job of it. So I took the ball and said, okay, well then let's look at these other people surrounding the story and who might have written it. And because, like I said, you know, there's no one place you can go and read about Joseph Matheny and Larry Haber and Temporal Recon and the sort of intricate web that ties them all together. So yeah, that's what I wanted to put together in the book. So in a way, it's a niche book for people that are already into John Teeter, but you know, like people like yourself that had maybe weren't so familiar with the story, they tend to get something out of it as well.
Oh yeah, well you cover the basics quite well, so I mean, I didn't have to read a whole nother book to figure out what was going on by reading when I was reading your book, and you have exclusive interviews in here with some of these people that are not available elsewhere.
Yeah, that's true, and I'm also I'm looking into doing a follow-up where I'm actually I've been speaking with some forensic linguists, and so I'm actually looking to do a sort of what the Hoax Hunter did, where the Hoax Hunter used a software program that may or may not be that, you know, effective. I'm actually working with these linguists, and they're going to do a forensic analysis comparing the John Teeter posts to the writings of some of these suspects, and then I'm going to frame that, essentially provide, you know, introductory notes to their findings, and that I'm not sure if that'll be a second book or just something that is done if on their end it may be done in an academic setting, and then I may piggyback on that for a follow-up book.
Okay, and again, your website is what?
www.mikesauve.com,
and that's S-A-U-V-E.
S-A-U-V-E.
And is your fiction available there as well?
Yeah, there's links to my two fiction books. My first book is The Wraith of Skrellman, kind of a coming-of-age story. And my second book is called The Apocalypse of Lloyd. I think viewers or listeners of your show would probably get a kick out of that because it's kind of a apocalyptic catch-all that involves a lot of the Freudian subjects we love to discuss. So, I think people that are interested in this sort of thing would probably particularly like The Apocalypse of Lloyd. And all of these books, The Wraith of Skrellman and Who Authored the John Teeter Legend, are also available as audiobooks on audible.com.
Nice.
I know I personally get so much more reading done through audiobooks now. It makes all the difference because everyone says they don't have time to read, right? And they feel guilty about it. But audiobooks are just great. You're walking to work or you're doing whatever, and it's just, I guess some people have a hard time with maintaining focus, but yeah, audiobooks for me are what keep me up to date with the reading I want to do.
Nice. Okay. And people, and you recommend people buy the stuff from your site because you and the publisher get a little more than if they buy it through Amazon.
Yeah, just slightly more. And it does. I mean, I'm totally fine if you want to go to Amazon, but I almost just say that as a public service announcement. People might not know that when, like, CreateSpace is a great tool because it cuts out the need to, you know, in the old publishing model, publisher would need to estimate how many books they're going to sell, have those books created. If they don't sell, it's a big waste. CreateSpace, it's all done on demand, right? So when you go and buy my book, it gets made at CreateSpace and sent to you. But as a result, they take a share of the profits, sure. A pretty sizable share of the profits. And the authors and publishers get slightly more when you follow the CreateSpace link rather than the Amazon link.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you for talking to us about this. And
thanks for having me.
And as I said, I very much enjoyed reading this. It was, if nothing else, it's a great story. You know, I personally don't believe he was a real time traveler. I do believe it's a story, but it doesn't make it any less entertaining. And I'd be, you know, totally open to proof that I was wrong on that.
Yeah, I mean, I always say no one would be happier than me if someone came forward and proved he was real, because it would mean there was a real time traveler, and it would sort of, you know, shake the very foundation of reality as we understand it. But, you know, if that's not true, then, well, at least we have this great story to keep us entertained.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you so much, Mike.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, and to take you out tonight, I think we're going to go with Say. I was looking for a song on time travel, and I can't find one to use, because I only use music I have permission to use. I'm sure there are songs about time travel out there, but I'm only using songs from artists who have given me permission. And if you are an artist and want me to use some of your stuff at the end of the show at some point, drop me a line, contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com. But I think we're going to close out with Strange Machine from Psyche Corporation off Crypts and Codes. Here you go.
Strange machine.